Lecture 28. Pasamambava Tusangkhapa, Tibetan Ideas.
Hello. Welcome back. Often in this course, it's difficult to draw a firm line between philosophy and religion. And as we saw in the last lecture on Japan, sometimes art gets thrown into the mix as well. But the identification of philosophy and religion is probably nowhere more pronounced than it is in Tibet, which is the subject of this lecture. Let's begin with three myths or misconceptions about Tibet. The first is that it's always been a peaceful Buddhist nation. Second, it's basically a part of China. And third, the Buddhism practice there, that's the religion of the Dalai Lama, is fairly typical of world Buddhism. Okay, all of those are misconceptions. The Tibetan cultural sphere is located in the Himalayan mountains north of India. It includes what's today the Tibet Autonomous Region in China, as well as independent nations of Nepal and Bhutan. This is one of the highest regions of the world, with an average elevation of 16,000 feet. That's 3 miles above sea level. Tibetan civilization began in the 7th century, when the area was unified by Songtsen Gampo, who established the Tibetan Empire, which dominated much of Central Asia and Burma. Like most empires, it was based on military might, and the Tibetans were fierce warriors who invaded neighboring countries, including China. They even occupied the capital of China, Xi'an, for a couple of weeks in 763, right at the tail end of the Anlushan Rebellion. Tibet and China signed a peace treaty in the 9th century, and then they remained separate nations until the Mongols conquered both of them in the 13th century. So during the Yuan Dynasty, Tibet was officially part of China, as part of this Mongol Empire. When the Mongol regime fell, Tibet again became independent until the 18th century, when the Chinese Qing Dynasty sent troops and asserted its authority there. At the end of the Qing Dynasty in 1912, that's when the last emperor abdicates, Tibet was once again in control of its own affairs, though that only lasted about half a century, until 1950, when the Chinese under Mao Zedong invaded. And then 9 years after that, the Chinese sent more troops in to crush revolt, and the Dalai Lama fled to Dharamsala in northern India. So, not all that peaceful of a history, and Tibet has spent more time independent of China than part of it. But what about Buddhism? The first Buddhists in Tibet were two wives of Songtsen Gampo, the founder of the Tibetan Empire. One of these Buddhist women was from Nepal, and the other was a Chinese princess. Both of them took their religion into the court, and then monks and missionaries from India soon followed, and Buddhism was adopted as the official religion of Tibet in the 8th century. The Buddhism that came in from India was Mahayana Buddhism. That also includes Madhyamaka and Yogacara, but it was combined with tantric or esoteric elements from India. So that's the use of mantras and mudras and mandalas as shortcuts to enlightenment. Those are the same sort of practices that Kukai made part of the Shingon school in Japan. In Tibet, there was also a strong influence from Bon, which is the native shamanistic religion. A shaman is a human intermediary to the spirit world. And these sorts of religions often feature like magical healings and interactions with both good and bad divinities. There were differences between what was going on in Tibet with what was happening in Southeast Asia, that's Theravada Buddhism, and in East Asia, which is Mahayana Buddhism, that the Tibetan form of Buddhism was recognized as a distinct third form called Vajrayana Buddhism. The word Vajrayana means thunderbolt or diamond, and the analogy is of being able to cut through any obstacles to enlightenment. So there's an emphasis in Tibetan Buddhism on rituals, and especially secret, esoteric rituals and meditative practices. Today, there are perhaps some 124 million Theravada Buddhists and 185 million Mahayana Buddhists, and then just 20 million Vajrayana Buddhists. So altogether, the number of Buddhists make up a somewhat less than the number of Protestants in the world. But 20 million Buddhists out of 329 million is not all that much. So although we often think Tibet when we hear the word Buddhist, the type of Buddhism practiced there is very much in the minority. And with that background, it's time to turn to some great minds. The first is Padmasambhava, who was an Indian monk in the 8th century. He He's one of the key figures who brought Buddhism to Tibet, and he's revered there today as Guru Rinpoche, which means the precious teacher. Padmasambhava was involved in the founding of the first monastery in Tibet, and his followers established the Nyingma school, which means the adherence of the old scriptures, tantras. Sometimes you might hear Nyingma Pa. There's a pa at the end of these schools that just means school. So the Nyingma Pa, the Nyingma school, are popularly known as the Red Hats. There are four major schools of Tibetan Buddhism, and it's probably useful to think of them like Catholic monastic orders, like Jesuits and Franciscans and Dominicans. I mean, there are differences between these schools, but many more similarities. The story of Padmasambhava's arrival in Tibet is that another Indian monk named Shantarakshita, who was a teacher of Mahayana from Nalanda University, visited Tibet, and then he ran into trouble with bone demons. There were plagues and floods, and lightning hit the palace, and people said, this is, you know, things are not going very well. And the king talked to this monk and said, you know, maybe you should go back. This isn't working out. And the monk said, I know a guy who I could recommend. His name is Padmasambhava, and he's a Buddhist that I know back in India, but he's mastered many of the magical spells and practices, and the kind of Buddhism that he has would be perfect for Tibet. So Padmasambhava was invited to Tibet in 747 from India, and he converted many of the local deities. I'm not exactly sure how you do that, but this is the story. And then he put those deities to work protecting Buddhism. And then Shantarakshita was also able to return, and a massive translation project began not long thereafter of translating Sanskrit scriptures into Tibetan. Since Buddhism comes to Tibet later than it gets to China or to Japan, the Tibetans have access to the very latest text. There's a vast library of recent tantras or esoteric texts that were never part of the East Asian Buddhist traditions. Tantra means the warp in weaving. So those are the linear threads that the weft then goes through. It holds everything together. And it's the same meaning as the Chinese word jing or classic, like in the Tao Te Ching. So there were both Hindu and Buddhist tantras. Padmasambhava was known as a holy man, and there are many legends about him, that he was born from a lotus flower in an 8-year-old body, just suddenly appeared, that he could understand the language of animals and raise the dead, that he could become invisible, and so forth. He's also thought to have buried hundreds of secret texts called terma all around Tibet that were recovered many centuries later by spiritual treasure revealers. And the most famous of these hidden texts is the Tibetan Book of the Dead. This is going to present something of a problem for us in this course. It seems appropriate to consider Padmasambhava a great mind because he's been very influential in Tibet. But we know his ideas mostly through these recovered treasure texts whose exact origins are somewhat shadowy. So it's a bit like how at the very beginning of this course, we considered the Vedas and the Upanishads as products of great minds, even though we didn't know much about their lives. The texts that are ascribed to Padmasambhava by various treasure finders are dense, and there are lots of them, and they have pretty complicated transmission histories. For instance, the Tibetan Book of the Dead was said to have been written and then hidden away by Padmasambhava in the 8th century, and then it was discovered by Karma Lingpa in the 14th century. It's a practical guide for soul. Actually, there's not souls in Buddhism. Let's say a practical guide for a consciousness who's negotiating that perilous 49-day interval between death and rebirth. And it's just a small part of a group of texts known as the Profound Doctrine of Self-Liberation by Meditation upon Peaceful and Wrathful Deities. Okay, that's a mouthful of a title. And that's supposed to go back to Padmasambhava. To get some sense of what that title might mean, this meditation on these different divinities, there's another book that's credited to Padmasambhava called the Dakini Teachings, which is perhaps a good place to see how his ideas fit into the larger history of Buddhist thought. A Dakini is a female tantric deity. He says the key to liberation from samsara is overcoming illusion and controlling one's mind, which is identical to the totality of reality. This is an influence of the Yogacara, the consciousness-only school. So this liberation can be accomplished in a step-by-step process. You begin by finding a qualified guru who can guide you through the various stages. And then you arouse a desire for enlightenment within yourself but not liberation just for yourself, but for all sentient beings as well. And this is the beginning of the Bodhisattva path, where you make a vow that you will become a Bodhisattva, that when you become enlightened, you're going to help everyone else as well. Next, you start a rigorous program of meditation. But unlike Zen, where you think of nothing or you concentrate on a koan, in Padmasambhava's tantric version, you focus on a personal deity, a idam. This type of meditation first starts out by using an image of this god or goddess, but then later on, you're supposed to be able to mentally visualize this deity, your personal deity, idam, so vividly that it seems as real as anything else. It's a self-conjured hallucination. Of course, that's the point, is that a visualized god or goddess is just as real as anything else, since they're all mental constructions, and since there's no difference between ultimate reality and one's mind. Indeed, there's no difference between the viewer and the vision. Okay, just as a side note, deities in Tibetan Buddhism, if you see some of the statues, they often are represented as having many arms, and that illustrates their power and their multitasking abilities. This form of iconography is something you might see also with regard to Hindu gods and goddesses. There's a close connection between what's happening in Tibet and what's happening back in India. Maybe on one more side note, in 792 to 794, the king of Tibet hosted a famous two-year debate between a Buddhist monk from India and a Zen monk from China. The Zen monk eventually lost that debate, and Tibetan Buddhism has consequently always been more oriented toward its neighbor to the south rather than to the east. So Tibet is going to be in the Darshana Hotel, part of the conversations there, as opposed to the Tao Hotel. In the centuries after Padmasambhava, Buddhism declined in Tibet, due in part to the withdrawal of political patronage. There was some outright hostility, sometimes from kings, sometimes from the bone priests, this earlier religion. And it also declined in response to the corruption in the Sangha. In particular, there were some tantric practices that were thought to be spiritually dangerous and subject to abuse. There were tantric masters who urged monks to eat meat or to fashion begging bowls out of human skulls. That's to demonstrate their indifference to the distinction between life and death, or what's desirable or disgusting. It just doesn't matter. And there were some who even taught that that certain types of sexual practices under certain conditions might be an aid to enlightenment rather than a hindrance. It's sort of like fighting fire with fire. Okay, right or wrong, you can see how this kind of thing might get out of hand. At the end of the 10th century, however, there was a second dissemination of Buddhism to Tibet. So it's declined. This is in the period when Tibet and China are separate from each other before the Mongols come in. And once again, monks start coming from India to Tibet. The most important of these men was named Atisha, and he had been the dean of Nalanda University, an institution we keep talking about in these lectures. Atisha lived from 980 to 1052, so he's a contemporary of Lady Murasaki in Japan. He was born in Bengal into a royal family. He showed spiritual tendencies even as a toddler, and on the eve of his wedding, he had a vision of the Vajrayana goddess Tara. She's a bodhisattva. And Tara, in this vision, warned Atisha that his destiny lay elsewhere. Marriage wasn't for him. So he gave an excuse that he was going on a hunting trip, but then he renounced his status and his possessions, became a monk, never showed up for his wedding, soon made his way to Nalanda University. He had a very successful career there. But in 1042, when the king of Tibet invited him to come and clarify the teachings of Buddhism, he moved north. Okay, he's 60 years old at this time, and it's a long, arduous journey. But he goes to Tibet, and he stays there for the last 12 years of his life. Actually, it might be worth talking a little bit more about this story. The king first offered a bunch of money because he was a famous scholar, tried to get him to come. And Atisha said, no, I'm not so interested. I've got things to do here, and I'm an old man. You don't want me. And the king in Tibet thought, well, maybe I didn't give him enough money. So he started gathering more money from around, and then eventually there were some political problems, and the king was captured by a rival king and imprisoned. And then the guy who's in control says, you know, I'll let him go if you pay a ransom. So the king's nephew went around and tried to get money for this. And the king, who's imprisoned, finally says, skip the ransom. Like, don't worry about me. Take all that money and send it to India. And let's get Atisha here. That's what we really need. And then the king dies in prison. He never gets out. Money goes to Atisha. He actually is not very interested in money, and he gives it away. But he is impressed by the king's devotion. He consults Tara, his Edom, the goddess. She says, you should go to Tibet. So that's what he does. Atisha, he primarily transmitted to his Tibetan students the Majjhimaka theories of the great second century Indian philosopher Nagarjuna. Remember, everything is emptiness. There are two levels of truth, conventional and ultimate truth, and then this fourfold negation or tetralemma. But Atisha also wrote a small book in which he brought together sort of the main points of all of the Buddhist teachings he'd encountered over his life at Nalanda. This book, which is called A Lamp for the Path to Enlightenment, sets out a spiritual journey that begins with morality, so you're strictly following the rules for monks that are found in the Theravada scriptures, and then it moves on to the wisdom and compassion of Mahayana Buddhism, and then culminates in the awakening that comes through tantric practices. This book has been a core text in Tibetan Buddhism, and Atisha's followers were known for their strict adherence to monastic discipline. Atisha had studied at Nalanda University under the famous tantric master Naropa, who later taught a young Tibetan monk named Marpa. Unlike Atisha, though, Marpa married when he returned to Tibet, and he became a layperson. He was nevertheless a major translator of Sanskrit texts and an influential teacher. He was one of the founders of the Kagyu school, and that means the oral lineage or the whispered transmission. This is the second major school of Tibetan Buddhism, and it places great emphasis on the transmission of tantric teachings from guru to disciple. Okay. Marpa's most prominent disciple was named Milarepa, and he's going to be one of our great minds here. He lives from 1040 to 1123. He's one of the most beloved figures in Tibetan history. Milarepa was a poet, a mystic, and a tantric adept who had come from a troubled family and used black magic to kill several family members in revenge. Okay, he was overcome by guilt after this and then went to study with Marpa for 12 years and eventually became enlightened in a single lifetime, which is a rather rare thing according to Tibetan Buddhism. Milarepa composed hundreds of songs, which he used to teach the common people the basic principles of Buddhism. His biography and his poems are among the most famous works of Tibetan literature. Milarepa sang songs about impermanence and suffering, about morality and renunciation and meditation. In one poem, he uses the analogy of a wild horse who can be caught by the lasso of equanimity and then tied to the post of meditation and then fed on the guru's teachings, watered with the purity of consciousness and kept warm in the enclosure of emptiness. Milarepa taught that absolute reality is outside of time and change, and that anyone who's saying all is one, anyone who's saying that is still in the grasp of discriminative thinking. Enlightenment has to be experienced directly. As he explains in his 100,000 songs, it's a collection of his poems and writings, in the realm of absolute truth, he says, and here's our quote, Buddha himself does not exist. There are no practices nor practicers, no path, no realization, no stages, no Buddha's bodies, and no wisdom. There is then no nirvana, for these are merely names and thoughts. So, just to be comprehensive now, we'll talk about the third Tibetan school, the Sakya school, which was named for the Sakya monastery where it began. This was founded in 1073. In the 13th century, the leaders of this school were closely allied with the Mongols. Some Mongols converted to Tibetan Buddhism, sometimes called Lamaism. A Lama, with one L, is an honorific title for a Buddhist teacher. Indeed, one of the Sakya leaders became a spiritual advisor to Kublai Khan, the Mongol emperor of China. But probably the school that most people are familiar with is the Gelug school, which is connected to the Dalai Lama and which was founded by Tsongkhapa, one of the most influential philosophers in Tibetan Buddhism, in Tibetan history. Tsongkhapa lived from 1357 to 1419. He was born in northeastern Tibet, and he showed remarkable religious and intellectual proclivities from a young age. This actually sounds like a lot of the people we're talking about today. He took the novice monk vows at the age of 7. So imagine him being like in second grade or so. He wrote detailed philosophical commentaries on some of the most significant Buddhist texts, and he also wrote practical manuals for meditation and spiritual progress. Tsongkhapa founded the great Ganden Monastery near the capital of Lhasa in 1409. Okay, this is a big deal. Later on, this monastery is huge. It has like 10,000 monks there. Tsongkhapa was a follower of Atisha, and he established the Gelug school, which the name means the order of virtue. And they're known as the yellow hats. The other three schools wear these red hats. And this school, his school, following on the lead of Atisha, was known for its high standards of monastic discipline and scholarship. Tsongkhapa cut down on magical practices, he insisted on vegetarianism, and he forbade sexual tantra for monks. Tsongkhapa was also a major figure in a renaissance of Buddhism in Tibet, and other monasteries, which became centers of learning, were constructed around the country during his lifetime. He had a hand in that. By the end of the 16th century, the Gelug school was the dominant school of Buddhism in Tibet. It's said that Tsongkhapa had an enlightenment experience after he dreamed one night of Nagarjuna and then woke up and read some of Buddhapalita's 6th century commentary on Nagarjuna's fundamental verses of the Middle Way. Now, Tsongkhapa himself wrote an extensive commentary on Nagarjuna's works in which he was responding to the 7th century commentator Chandrakirti. As you might imagine, this gets to be a bit thick since we're talking about commentaries on commentaries. And Robert Thurman's translation of Tsongkhapa's Essence of True Eloquence bristles with technical terminology. For example, he talks about the distinctiveness of their negation of intrinsically identifiable intrinsic reality. Okay, that means something, but it's pretty complicated. For this course, we might simply note that Tsongkhapa was trying to reconfigure Nagarjuna's ideas so that they didn't negate everything, so that we'd have some basis for action in our conventional, everyday experience of the world. Tsongkhapa also sought to systematize Majjhimaka metaphysics and then reconcile them with Yogacara's emphasis on mind and then also the tantric practices that involve the body. He taught that Nagarjuna's doctrine of emptiness supports the traditional ethical rules for monks and also provides a foundation for tantric attainments. In his book, The Great Exposition of the Stages of the Path, which is a loose commentary on an elaboration of Atisha's lamp for the path to enlightenment, Tsongkhapa saw the process of spiritual awakening as divided into three main stages. You start with renunciation, right? When you realize what a rare opportunity it is to have been born as a human being, especially if you're a human being who has access to the Dharma and scriptures and teachers. Like, don't waste your opportunity. Now is the time to give up regular life and start on this path as a monk. Stage number two is compassion. You have a desire to become enlightened, not just for yourself, but for the good of others, because you recognize that all beings are suffering. And Tsongkhapa says, you also recognize that in this constant cycle of reincarnation, every living creature at one time or another has been your mother in some lifetime. Okay, and then from compassion, the third stage is wisdom, penetrating insight into emptiness. One of Tsongkhapa's disciples was the first Dalai Lama, and that means the Lama is a teacher, right? And Dalai means the ocean. So the idea is this: the teacher is a spiritual attainments are as vast as the ocean. This title, the Dalai Lama, was bestowed by the Mongol Khan in 1578 on the third incarnation in that line. And then it was applied retroactively to his two predecessors. The Dalai Lama is the leader of the officials of the Gelug school. And the rather amazing thing is that they are chosen as children. When a Dalai Lama dies, the high Gelug Lamas consult oracles, and then they look for a child that he's been reborn as, right? So he dies, and then there's a child born not long thereafter who's going to be his incarnation. And usually this process of identifying someone takes a couple of years. When they've got a candidate, they usually have several, but they test them by presenting this boy with several artifacts, maybe some glasses or a prayer wheel or a staff that had belonged to the previous Dalai Lama. And if this boy is able to identify the right ones as belonging to him, Then he's taken to a monastery and he's raised there. The fifth Dalai Lama in the 17th century, with help from the Mongols, put down warlords in Tibet and consolidated both religious and political power. He's sometimes known as the Great Fifth, like this is the high point of the Dalai Lamas. When the Manchu people from north of Korea defeated the Mongolians and then took over all of China in 1644, they allied themselves with this line of Dalai Lamas. The Manchus recognized the authority of the Lamas, and the Dalai Lamas, in return, acknowledged the Manchu emperor's claims in China and in Mongolia. And the Manchus also sent resident representatives, and sometimes some troops, to Tibet to make sure the Dalai Lama was serving their interests. Now, this method of choosing a successor is somewhat counterintuitive. I mean, imagine what it might look like in other fields. There was a New Yorker cartoon that showed three business types in suits sitting on a sofa talking to some young parents. In the background is a little boy playing with blocks. And the caption says, "We've traveled the world looking for our next CEO, as was foretold in our corporate legends. We think your little Tim might be that CEO." Actually, one of my missions in life is to try to help my students understand New Yorker cartoons. This is kind of a strange way of choosing a successor, but I guess it makes sense in terms of reincarnation and karma. It also might make some practical sense in that the leader of the Gelug school is going to be trained from as a child. He's not going to come in with a lot of connections to other aristocrats or nobilities or people in power. And then also a regent gets a chance to run things until this boy grows up. Okay, however this works, there are about 350 tulkus in Tibet today. And tulkus are lamas who can choose their rebirth. So they have these lines of reincarnation. There are a few female lines as well. The Dalai Lama is the most important of these, and he's thought to be an incarnation of Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva, who's also known as Guanyin in China. The number two reincarnation is Panchen Lama, who's an incarnation of Amitabha, but there are many more. The system hasn't always worked smoothly. The seventh Dalai Lama, for example, was something of a drinker and a womanizer, and there's sometimes been some political interference in the identification of reincarnated lamas. But the current Dalai Lama, the 14th, has been a remarkable spokesman for Buddhism in general and for Tibetan Buddhism in particular. Tenzin Gyatso is his name, and he was born in 1935. He was identified as the Dalai Lama at the age of 2, and then he was taken to the Potala Palace in Lhasa for an intensive Buddhist education at 6. As the leader of spiritual and political, actually he's both the political and the spiritual leader in Tibet, he was put under enormous pressure when the Chinese invaded in 1950. And then during the 1959 crackdown, he and his government fled to Dharamsala, India, where he's been headquartered ever since. Tibetan Buddhism was severely persecuted during the Chinese Cultural Revolution that took place from 1966 to 1976. At that time, 6,000 monasteries were destroyed, along with their libraries and their artwork, and as many as 1 million Tibetans were killed. Nevertheless, the Dalai Lama has always urged Buddhist solutions to terrible political problems. And in 1989, he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. Today, Tibetan culture is threatened by political and demographic trends, which is unfortunate because it includes a number of fascinating, distinctive practices. These include a particular form of logical argumentation found in monastic training in monasteries, where a seated defender must respond to a standing challenger who hurls questions at him and gesticulates wildly in a very regulated sort of way. There are also colorful, stylized tanka paintings that depict various Buddhas or mandalas. And there's throat singing in which individual monks, a single monk, is able to produce multiple musical tones at the same time. And then they also use mantras like Om Mani Padme Om, which is often invoked by the followers of the Dalai Lama. The Om it doesn't mean anything. It's a syllable that has spiritual profundity. But Mani Padme refers to the jewel in the lotus. And this is often inscribed on prayer wheels that can be spun so as to gain the same effect as audibly repeating a prayer. In fact, Tibetan monks are praying every day for the welfare of all sentient beings. And I suppose that includes you. So if things are going pretty good, pretty well for you so far today, perhaps you should thank them. For me, one of the most beautiful and poignant of Tibetan practices is the painstaking, meticulous creation of sand mandalas, in which individual grains of colored sand are arranged into elaborate designs over the course of several days or even weeks. I mean, we're talking about tens of thousands of individual grains of sand. And these beautiful, quite large mandalas. And then, when it's finished, it is reverently and ritually destroyed. And the sand is poured into a river so it can turn into something else. You really should take a look at some of these on YouTube videos. Remember that Buddhism is based on the insight that nothing lasts forever. That's sort of what these sand mandalas show. And if nothing lasts forever, you shouldn't want it to either. Which brings us to the end of this lecture.